You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody. Away we go again. Welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby with me, Alex Payne. We're joined this week by the Husk and the Lord. We've got quite a lot to get into, actually. It seems to be the way at the moment in rugby union. But before we do, we did just want to quickly mark and say thank you to Dan Lear, who joined us last week. A really fascinating canter around the course with him in terms of his new documentary. And I know it seems to have evoked quite a lot of emotion from a lot of you, the readers and the viewers and the listeners. So thank you for all the feedback that you've sent. It's also really heartening to hear that you have actively got off the sofa and done something about it. We hear that we've raised or helped raise £10,000 in merchandise sales in the last week for his range of T-shirts and posters to help the Pacific Welfare sustain their drive for the game that so desperately needs it. That is remarkable. And, you know, Dan's got a great cause and great drive. But thank you to all of you who have chipped in and got involved off the back of what you've heard from him over the course of the last week or so. Thanks also for the feedback that you've sent us, most of which resembled how we felt at the end of it all. It just is a massive sense of frustration right now. At the studios, I watched the doc after listening to the pod, and I actually feel embarrassed to be a rugby fan. I feel conned. What can we do as fans? Mike Lloyd, I'm completely dismayed by the whole situation. I've loved this great game all my life because of its values, but unfortunately this documentary has shattered that illusion. And Craig Keach, who said, I don't think I can let this podcast go. You have the great and the good on every week, and this matter should be pushed onwards and upwards. The Islanders provide dynamism, professionalism, honesty, and the very best entertainment across the globe, and they should not be fobbed off any longer. It's got people talking, Haskin. It's got people wanting to do things. It's been very interesting reading the feedback that we've had. What's been coming through your DMs in amongst the usual smut and abuse?
Well, actually, there isn't any smut, which is very disappointing. I don't get anything. I actually get quite a lot of compliments, which is quite nice. And then just some odd people that go, hi. And I'm like, well, I don't want you to do that. So, yeah, it's an interesting one because I think with a lot of issues in the world at the moment, and I can't remember if I mentioned this on the podcast or not, because people feel like they're talking about it, they feel like they're doing something. And actually, it's quite a dangerous period because just talking about it, you feel like you've had the conversation and you could move on. I think the overarching thing for me, and I love Dan, but it's very much, they obviously understand what the problem is and, you know, they're raging against the machine to fix it. The problem is that they've had no luck actually getting to the table and no progress or only small bits of progress. My concern is actually the doors were opened. Is there a clear and succinct plan as what to do next? You know, I think there are some certain things that could, you know, easy wins, and it took us a show to get through that as to what we feel would be an easy win. And one of the things was eligibility rules. And I think that's something that could be easily debated. I don't think it's a hugely dramatic topic, because why would World Rugby want to deal with dictatorship? Because the problem is that the money would just continue to disappear and there isn't the structure. And I kind of feel sorry for Dan, because he's done what no Pacific Islander has been able to do, brought the agenda to the forefront, speaks very clearly about it. But I also think he's sort of lacking the support. He's a bit of a lonely island, actually. And I think the fact that people want to get behind him is great. But fixing and throwing money at the situation isn't right. And my concern is, if we got to the top table, would there be a clear plan? Because just giving a load of money isn't going to fix it. And I think there are some small changes that could happen.
I think there's quite a lot of questions that have come out of it. A, who sits at the top of the Pacific Island boards, each individual, and are they the right people to do it? And when World Rugby pass things around, that is one thing they can control, with fit and proper ready tests for who sits at the top and manages that money that comes in. In the documentary, it talks about the millions that went missing, and it was quite an opener as well in terms of finding out how much they were getting paid. But ultimately, it needs to be run properly at the top of the game, because what they don't have is they don't have a home sort of competition where they can grow and breed talent. Talent has to go abroad to play in the top leagues if they want to play for that. One question is, A, getting the right people running Fiji, Samoa, Tonga with honest, upfront money goes back into it, doesn't go into anyone else's pocket. It goes into supporting the rugby union, and then if that happens, putting it back into the youth program and getting some other options for kids who are playing on the islands. Two, when a player leaves the Pacific Islands, if he goes to New Zealand, does he then have to play for New Zealand? Is that part of what is in a Super 14 contract, that if you go and play for a New Zealand franchise or a Australian franchise, you have to then be eligible for Australia? Because surely they can't do that. Or if they do make people do that, can there be a subsidy? So if you're not born in Australia and then you play for Australia, they have to send per player an X amount of sum per cap back to Samoan, the Pacific Island nation that they were born in. That's what I don't understand, is if you play for a Super Rugby team in Australia or New Zealand, do you have to be eligible to play for New Zealand or Australia?
Whether you have to be or whether you are actively encouraged, I don't know where the boundary is between that. I don't know the answer.
So I'd want some clarity about that, because if it's not, and they could still choose to play for the Pacific Island nation, why don't the players play for them?
Why?
If they're still getting...
If you then lose your club contract once you are ineligible to play...
Then that answers the question. They are being held... If they are sort of not being held for ransom, but sort of are, if you want to play in Australia and New Zealand, then you have to play for Australia and New Zealand, then I don't feel that's right. You still should be able to play for the Crusaders and play for Fiji or Samoa or Tonga. Then ultimately, will rugby need to stop passing things around? They run the game, so they need to build the plan of how you make this work.
I also think with World Rugby, the size of the organisation, just like global charities, right, charities collect hundreds of millions of pounds. They don't just post that to the warlord and go, right, here you are. They have ways and means of going to deliver aid and stuff without it getting into hand. Obviously, there's lots of cases where the money goes into these countries and no one ever sees it. I think World Rugby could manage the accounts for the islands, and then.
But I think they do. I think they do. I mean, and I think they've got checks and balances and escrow, whatever it's called. World Rugby are. I do feel for World Rugby. There's a lot of good that they're doing that they don't get the credit for, and there's a lot that's going on that they can't talk about. But the one thing I felt off the back of chatting to Dan last week is that he needs a very simple 5-point plan, and the foremost thing he's got to get done is get politicians out of sport. Yeah. And I don't know whether that's something that World Rugby have to ratify and sign off on. But if you hold a political office, full stop, you are not involved in the running of or the administration of sport.
Or if you're a brother to someone who runs it, you can't do that either. I completely agree.
Until they clear up their own house, there's no point sending money, shouting about it, etc. Because what you're putting into it won't necessarily end up where you want it to get to.
We see World Rugby as a big anonymous body that is easy to point fingers at. And I think the problem is that this has been going on for such a long time, it's been perpetuated for such a long time, it's very difficult. And I think because we don't have the full agenda and the full details, it is very, a lot of the stuff I say is very much more like questions as to why, you know, because we don't have any experience, because it's very difficult to understand what, for example, World Rugby does in these things, or what it doesn't do, because you just don't see this. All you hear is kind of the outcry of the other side. Yeah. But I think the first port of call in anything in life is you've got to look at your own house first and go, is my house in order? And I think clearly the Pacific Islanders' houses aren't in order. But I think there is some stuff we could do in a more structured way to help them. But I also think there are some easy wins that I think Dan needs to just get his head round and remember that, you know, it's about the small battles. The war is going to take a long time to change.
We have actually had a chat with World Rugby and are hoping that we might be able to have a really good session with Brett Gosper and bounce around all these questions and all these points that seem to come out of the woodwork every time we hear about, you know, the plight of the Pacific Islands, and hopefully we'll get the chance to do that sooner rather than later. Coming up on this show, that we're going to reflect on the third weekend in the Autumn Nations Cup. We're going to preview the final this weekend as well. But before we do that, we actually just wanted to take a few moments to reflect on the life of the great Christoph Dominici, who very sadly passed away last week at the age of just 48. I mean, it stops you in your tracks. Dominici played 67 times for his country, played in four Six Nations winning teams, including two Grand Slams. He won the French Championship 5 times with Stade Francais before retiring in 2008. And we've all been watching all week the extraordinary footage of that 1999 semi-final against the All Blacks, where he just ripped it up. And in order to sort of put a bit of perspective on this, James, I know you obviously played with him at Stade, but it's very nice to welcome back an old friend of ours, the man who's sort of single-handedly bringing class to Amazon Prime's coverage. Your English is better than almost everybody else, certainly Dylan Hartley's. Benjamin Kayser, how are you, first of all? Lovely to see you. How are you getting on?
Thanks for having me. Hi, guys. It's a bit complicated for me to joke around when you start with hitting me straight away with that hard subject of Domi.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That wasn't very well done. But yeah, let's start with Christoph, first of all. Tell us about the last week from your perspective. How on earth do you get your head around it?
So to be totally honest with you, it's been a bit of a... It forced me into reflection that I didn't really want to have because... I stopped rugby in June 2019, and ever since I've been flat out at just doing other things, trying to keep myself busy. And I never pressed pause on any of what I've done, just to reflect, take a second, you know, to know what you've done, just to know where you are, where your head is at, and stuff like that. And I've been wondering if that was the right strategy, or at least I'm telling myself that in the next couple of weeks, I need to, or months, whatever, I need to do that at some point. Because I chat a lot to my dad and stuff, who just thinking about the fact that, yeah, it's a big change. You know, it's a big change. You were used to doing crazy things. We're a bit crazy animals, you know, the rugby players. We've got some anger inside us that we need to get out at some point, somehow, some way. And it just got me thinking because I was speaking to all those guys from Stade, you know, but think about this guy. We're talking about Domi a lot because he had fire inside him. He was an incredibly charismatic, warm, dynamic. He just had the light on him. You know, when somebody walks in a room and all you wanted to do is listen to him. He would never be the most serious, but wow, he was entertaining. So Hask knew him as a coach. So obviously, they had a different relationship. But imagine, I started in 2003, 2004 at Stade. I was 18, 19. He was already a legend, and he was absolutely brilliant. So he would never talk to me when things were going well, but he would talk to me when things were going bad. And he would be the type of guy, he's like, just sit next to me, mate. You'll be all right. You'll be all right. Come with daddy, you know? Then he would convince us basically that we were capable of doing anything. He was scared of no one, nothing, never. Nothing was too big, too shiny, or too impossible to get. And he drove that mentality into all of us. So the reason why I tell you that is pushing me into that introspection sort of is because I really feel that crazy, incredible, wonderful, whatever personality that he had, which applied so well to professional sport and to a contact professional sport, is what drove him to the ground afterwards, because he just filled the cracks and the void left by the lack of competition and the things that you will never be able to reproduce. You know, the 5 minutes before a game when you want to puke, the 5 minutes after a game when you're crazy on a high, happy. This, you know, you got to move on. And he just filled those gaps, this gap and those cracks with shit, to be fair. And that's what caused him to go. So I will always remember him as somebody who just helped me. He's one of those blokes, you know, he gave me a hand. I didn't have boots. He called the Nike guy. The next day I had a contract for 3 years. I tried to give him a bottle of wine to say thank you. He threw the bottle of wine in my face. He said, never again. He never wanted anything back, but he would just give a lot. He never gave me any piece of opinion about my throwing, about my playing, about whatever it was. But like I would be playing those mind games with myself about, not playing those mind games, but fighting with my mind to get better at throwing. He would just be the guy, you know, be next to you. Ugh, stop a pair on you, pussy. You know, that's the type of guy that he was. Yeah, he was just an incredible player. But imagine the same person that you see on the field, off the field. He was that nice, kind, charismatic, could go through a mountain and everybody would follow him because you would want to. So he's going to live a huge void. I've got a lot of thoughts with his two girls and his family that they're leaving behind. Somebody so precious that should have not left this young and this early. So I think it's down to us now to say, I'm going to work on myself to try to learn and, you know, try to go. But I think it's also down to all of us to think that if we're brothers on the field, we need to be brothers off the field. It's one thing to say, Hask, how you doing? Yeah, I'm fine. But us men, we need to strap a pair on and actually go further than that. You know, actually care for each other. Actually know that we all have things that we have to deal with. Shit happens to anyone all the time. Post-rugby is a tough one because I never want to experience that again.
It's an amazing tribute, Ben. It's really lovely to hear you speak so passionately. And, you know, they always say the brightest stars burn out fastest. We often talk on this show about, you know, doing a lot of talking and a lot of not enough doing. I just wonder, you know, does this feel like a moment in French rugby potentially where actually people will start to do things rather than just talk about it? Or is that trying to attach too much to some very raw emotions right now?
If I just jump in there, because it gave, same with Ben, it gave me some time to reflect. Obviously, I played, I watched him. I had just broken into the England team and been on the World Cup squad in 99 when obviously he was causing mayhem against New Zealand. Got to play against him for the next 8 years, every year. But then since then, there was this thing called the snow rugby where we went and played sevens on the snow up in France, and he always played in there. And randomly, I spoke to Lee Mears, who is the most in touch with his feelings you'll ever find. And we talked about the fact of when we spoke to him and were the signs, were the cracks, maybe our French-English divide was. And it didn't even dawn on me. I know that Hask said he'd had issues in 2012, but I just didn't. I spoke to Mears. I said, did you have any feeling of the void that had been left? And Mears, he didn't know. And I never saw it. And what Ben's just said there sort of rings a little bit in terms of men are such idiots sometimes in terms of they paper over those cracks when there is a loyal band of, well, you hope there's a loyal band of brothers who would delve in, but they just need, you just need inviting sometimes. And that's the saddest part is, I got to speak to him, got to have laughs, got to have jokes with him. Only 3 years ago when we did the snow rugby, and yet didn't even dawn on me, didn't even sort of pick up the signs or anything. And that's the tough thing is we need to be able to find a way of reading these signs or getting into someone's head and understanding it and be there in a supportive way that we can be. And I don't know how we as blokes do it, but we've got to do it better.
So, Ben, I suppose that comes back to my question. I mean, are people in France... tell us about the reaction in France, first of all, because, I mean, we saw that extraordinary front page. I think it was L'Équipe. Just an amazing photograph. Can you give a sort of sense of where the French sporting public are a week on and just, where the questions lie and where the sort of the desire to do something about it sits right now?
For one, you need to understand the impact of Christophe Domici is that he represents everything that we love in France. The titan against the little passionate guy, and just his heart is big enough to conquer anything. So that's typically John Alomo against him, 99 semi-final. That's what we loved about it. He represents everything that we want to be as French people. Different, not the biggest, not the strongest, but we can do stuff differently if our heart takes us there. He was also very much in touch with emotions, in the good, but also in the bad ways. He was that kind of open-hearted guy that wasn't shy of showing who he was inside. So that's why he represented for us. So that's why I need to remember last time that sort of a headline was made solely on one bloke. It is big. It's the, one of the symbols of the last 30 years of whatever of sports that left us. And that's the void that he's leaving. I don't believe that enough is done at the moment. I believe, because I sort of have a look, I think Hask, you're part of it, that Lucids and all that, and you guys relay. I think that's brilliant. It's raising awareness. Nobody's too big, too strong, and invincible. And if us as professional rugby players or ex-sportsmen, whatever, show the example of saying, listen, I can deal with my shit. But having mental issues doesn't mean that you're going to take a rifle and go shoot people in school. It just means that everybody's got shit that they need to deal with. Everybody's got stuff going on. And that as professional sportsmen, I think we need to understand the fact that post-rugby is a dramatic change. In France, we call it la petite mort, the little death. It is a part of your soul that's going. That doesn't mean that the life after is always going to be worse. It just means that you have a lot to deal with, and you need to learn. And I think to answer Mike's point, I think we need the tools, because I actually don't know how to do it. I think there's specialists in that. It's a bit like 25 years ago, we used to do some conditioning and the people would run around and you need to run a 3K in X amount of minutes. And now they're completely gone from it. And we go into detail and everything. I think professional sports needs to just address this as another technique. And maybe you can actually learn from it in different ways, not just to prevent depression and bad stuff. You can actually help it for motivation and techniques for team motivation and dealing with stress and whatever it is. They should emphasize on the fact that people should be not only aware, but actually learn techniques to prevent, to help, and to recover from it. And I think we should learn, basically. I think we should learn. I think we should acquire some new tools to not only just raise awareness, but actually do something about it, just like you said, because it is a very, very tough one.
Ask.
Is there any form of psychological stuff in French rugby? Because I didn't see it when I was there, but I probably couldn't have understood what was going on.
No, I think it's very much self-initiatives. If you know what I mean, so I know a few guys. There is this sports psychologist and you know stuff like that. I know that Teddy Riner, you know, the massive judo guy, has worked with a very, very famous woman who's now getting on all the top guys. But it's mainly individual sports because that plays a huge, huge part of it. I'm not aware, to be honest, of. I'm aware of guys who sort of motivational speakers or team cohesion, you know, but never somebody who actually focuses on you so, individually.
Yeah. So if I said to you, right, of all the things that you mentioned, performance, dealing with stress, psychology, trying to optimize yourself, all these kind of things, is there anything even in the French national side like that?
Well, the current national side, I'm not aware of, but before there wasn't anything there. But also, you have to understand that's also the French psychology. If you bring something, we need to be convinced that it can be good for us. You know, we need to be convinced that it can be a tool, because you guys are more open-minded about, not maybe not open-minded, but you know, more ready to try, ready to experiment. We will commit 150% if you need to. You know what I mean? But we need to be convinced, and I think the team needs to be ready. The boys need to be ready.
Because I have said this time and time and again, and I have said. You know, I've joked tongue-in-cheek about my time in France when you came on and so eloquently put it on when you were last on the podcast about, you know, all jokes aside, what it was like in French rugby. I have genuinely said a million times, I've said it in my book, I've said it everywhere, that France could be the best team in the world if they had a team psychologist. Because if you can harness the power of the mind, everything you said, and like what you said there, it almost sounded like it was a surprise to you. I know you're a really intelligent guy, but saying, actually, you know, it's not about, I can't leave the house because I'm so depressed. It's not because something traumatic happened to me as a kid. It's, you know what, I'm having a shit day. My wife's upsetting me. I'm stressed. I've lost my identity. And these are things that, not my wife stressed me out. She's been wonderful. But me, I've lost my identity since I play. I do a million different things, but I used to be somebody. And now I'm not. I used to be good at something-ish, and now I'm not. And these things play on your mind. And, you know, when I read about Christophe, I sat on the side of the bed, and I went, fucking hell. I said, Christophe Dominici. And Chloe was like, you know, she went, oh, my God, that's terrible. And I said, fucking hell, it's so surprising. And she went, no, it's not. She said, because you fucking guys do not talk about your emotions in any way, shape, or form. You don't share. She wasn't talking specifically about him, but in general. And the fact that the biggest killer of men under 40 is suicide. And I actually did a podcast before I came on today, specifically about mental health, myself and a couple of other mates, just talking about how we felt. And not the answer, like, we're fine, how we kind of talked about stuff. And do you know what was really interesting? Yes, we've got psychologists now with teams, and I think still because... in England, we've had them, but they're still seen as an accessory to the team because the coaching staff, you can see, they've read somewhere in a manual that they should have them, but they never use them as a player. So they're sort of quite sceptical. So they're in and around the team, but on the outer circle. You've got someone like me that used a psychologist from 19 to 35 because I didn't have any, like, well, I've got lots of issues going on, but nothing that you would class as, like, super serious. But stuff in terms of, I want to get consistent performance. Do you know what? I want to deal with stress. I want to deal with my understanding of how to communicate better with coaches and how to deal with negative feedback. That's what I did. But we don't do anything about how we are. And interestingly enough, Craig White, who we've talked about in the podcast before, who's a pioneer with Uruguay before their World Cup, when he was working with them, they used to sit down and have sort of sharing circles, right? That people would talk about how they felt and what they felt about specific things. And you saw when they beat Fiji, the captain talk about how united they were and how positive they were. And the thing with mental health is that we are doing a lot of talking about it, but because we talk about it, we feel like we're doing something and we're actually not. We're actually not doing anything about it. And I think people like loose heads and stuff is so important. But, you know, the cognitive health of players and people is so important, and especially for men, especially sports people or people changing careers, is incredibly important. And I just think that, you know, as rugby clubs and people, we need to take more care of these things, because I'm astounded that, you know, I thought they didn't have it in France, and in England we've got it, but it's sort of lip service a bit. It's something that's got to change, because you're telling me you've got 40 lads the whole time who, you know, are always going through something, and they all hide it, and it's like, it's no good.
But to go back on your point, it's funny because I'm back studying at Oxford. I'm doing an MBA, and part of my cohort, there's an ex Navy SEAL. The guy did 17 years of Navy SEAL, so, like, I think I'm tough shit, but he's seen it all. And we're talking about that. He said he's lost more mates post-combat by suicide that on the field. And I was like, bloody hell. I mean, like Navy SEAL, you know, they're like the toughest of the toughest. They go where you would not even put like a finger, a toe or whatever. And we're chatting about all those things. And that's, he's created the foundation and stuff. And we've got a project actually just for the studies of literally that. What do you do from that? Those campfires are fantastic. They do the same thing where they basically strip off their grads and whatever. They go topless around, you know, everybody's on the same level and you just share what happened on the field, post field, whatever. But that's one thing, which is fantastic. That's putting a foot through the door. That's fantastic. That's just the first time. But then what do we do from there? And I think we're all lacking of tools, of skills, of knowledge about it. But to acquire those skills, it needs to become a priority. Yes. And I think it is down also to the organizational structure to put player welfare back in the middle. And if they do so, they will implement that from 16, 17, when you're in the academy, you know that that's a tiny bit of your week that you need to give. And maybe you'll need 1 minute because you're fine. But the one time when you'll need the help, the one time you'll have the tools and you'll have the help system.
And Ben, interestingly, I think the team that can harness the psychological battle for the good, but also for the performance, will be the side that rise above it. Because if you look at world rugby now, everything is equal. Everyone's the same size. Everyone's as big. Everyone's as fit. Everyone's taking the same supplements. What is the one untapped source that people haven't looked into? It's the mind. And if you can get 30 players who are able to share, be confident, trust each other, because I've played with people and I'm pretty certain I knew their name and that was probably about it, because we don't talk about, you don't, you know, you sort of sit around, have coffees and a laugh, but you don't, there's some people you don't gravitate towards. In the beginning, even if it's forced, not shit leadership stuff that we get people coming in with PDFs and, you know, tell me what colour animal I am, I'm a fucking peacock, all that shit. Actually sitting down and going, you know, building a relationship, someone sharing, but also sharing stuff in a circle, but also the application on performance. Instead of going after a game, what did we do wrong? And they all go, oh, well, we had a slow start. Why did I have a slow start? Oh, I don't know. But I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to train harder this week and we're going to work hard. And everyone goes, yeah, and they leave the room. That is the emotional equivalent of telling a depressed person to cheer up and them going, yeah, God, I don't know why I was so upset. And then just getting, it's like nothing's changed. And that is top level coaching in a moment. That is, we're good men, so we'll admit we made mistakes. We'll put our hands up. There's no, do you know why we were slow? Why did we beat the shit out of each other on a Tuesday and then turn up on Saturday and we all wanted to have a lie down and cuddle each other? Well, you know, why do we train that if you don't do this now, you're not going to do that then? So you're telling me that I have to fill someone on a Tuesday to go well on Saturday. If that's the case, there's something very mentally wrong with me that I can't switch on. And it's just, you know, it's all with the health stuff as well. I'm astounded that there's no kind of welfare stuff for it.
If I might add something, it's not really the sort of psychological side, but it's more like the culture and environment and team motivation. It's not to talk about the salary cap of Saracens, it's a different story. But I know for a fact that they're pretty driven from inside, right? They've got this thing about them that their success wasn't only down to salary cap. They cheated, they got caught, fair enough. They needed to pay, no problem. But I remember, obviously, they beat me a fair few times. So I was quite jealous of them, you know. You constantly look at your competition and you want to beat them and do better. And the one thing they did do better, I mean, I think the training center is very average. I think their stadium is extremely average. I would never swap it for Marcel Michelin. I was like, but what did I have more? And David Strettel was always telling me, oh, you know, the culture. You don't realize they hardly have any fans. They whatever. It's not that. It's the culture. I said, okay. And then I watched that Challenge Cup quarterfinal, semifinal. I can't remember, Bristol, Bordeaux. And Ben Earl, you know, now plays there. He's on loan. And he got man of the match. And the guy gets man of the match. He's wearing a Bristol shirt. And they're like, oh, congratulations and stuff. Are you happy? He's like, yeah, I'm happy. What does it feel like to be a Bristol Bear? I think the guy says in that. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm here. But, you know, I'm just on loan. I'm just on loan for a year. Then I'm going back to London. Oh, by the way, we are playing tomorrow against Leinster. That was Saracens. We are playing tomorrow. And I hope that we win. And I'm looking at this guy. And he's just man of the match with the Bristol Bear jersey on. Still on. He still has, like, sweat and blood in it. And he's always still thinking about his brothers back over there. So, yes, they cheated. Yes, the salary cap. But the mind is incredibly powerful. The mind is the one that will get it. That's where I agree with Haas. That's going to be the added value with other teams. That's how they build their success. Yes, of course, they cheated. Fair enough. And they did stuff that they shouldn't have done. Okay. And that was wrong. But that side, at least, you can't take away from them that their success is based on bloody motivation and pride of feeling part of the jersey. You know, pride of the jersey and all that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating listening to the two of you bounce us around. And it feels from the outside that we're talking about the sort of the mental ability to find peak performance, which as a professional rugby player, you can help, you know, through conditioning. But once you've stopped, it's about the support that you require. You know, you talk about the little death. I mean, I they feel like two very different conversations.
I think there's one thing I just wanted to clear up quickly as well, just to say that, So there's a fantastic doctor at WASPs, a guy called Dr. Ralph Mitchell, who's brilliant, who listens to the podcast, who it's been really helpful to me in retirement in terms of, you know, dealing with my the extra pain and everything else. Like I said, being in pain after playing for the last 10 years, you know, will affect you. But he's actually pioneered a mental health protocol, which is now being rolled out to the clubs. I remembered it while Ben was talking, where essentially you have these checks. Because there have been cases of, obviously, I work very closely with Restart. And actually, bizarrely, Restart is about to run out of money and not be able to provide this mental health hotline. So, you know, the obviously at the moment, there was this anonymous hotline where players could call up and reach in, which is something they've been doing, you know, which you hope someone like Christoph would have been able to do if they'd had something similar. But, you know, when you're feeling desperate, you'd be able to call someone up. And we know that it saved people's lives. It stopped people committing suicide. That's about to run out of money. But Ralph has brought this protocol in where it's actually going to check on players. So you come in after a thing like, you have to verbally check in with some, how are you, what's the story? Because there's been like academy players in certain things who've sort of gone neglected who were going to take their own lives, who were self-harming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that is brilliant, but I think exactly what you're saying, that there are two splits. There is the performance and there is the emotional side, but I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think they do come into one. You know, if someone is happy and sane and comfortable, they will do well. But I think we are making some strides. So it's not all doom and gloom, but I think it's got to be something that's much more commonplace. And I'd be interested with Ben actually to ask him, you know, you talked about this brotherhood that you had. Have you been relying on them in this week? You know, have you actually reached out and spoken to each other and shared these moments?
So there's do you remember Mathieu Blin, the former hooker who is very, very, it's funny. I remember when, after you left Stade, he basically retired the year after, I think. And then he went into the equivalent of the RRPA, so the Proval. And he was the first one to implement a anonymous telephone line linked to a psychologist. So basically you have a worry, you just want to speak to somebody professional who's got the proper tools, everything's anonymous, nobody will know who you are, how you are, whatever. He told me he was blown away by the numbers. I think there's about 350 professional players in France. I think the lady, or I think it was the two of them, whatever, they had 100 calls a week. It might be more than once per person, don't get me wrong, but it still means that there was help needed. You know, there was something needed. And Mathieu basically reached out to all the old Stade guys this week to sort of, he was basically offering a hand, you know, he's very touching in emotion. I think his parents are psychologists, so he's been sort of raised into those techniques. So that's why I do think that the future is. And I don't think it's that much different than motivation, because it's just environment and having the tools. The way that you use them, that is different, obviously. It's a different spectrum. But it's like driving a normal car and going Formula One racing. You're still driving. But it's different tools, different ways that you use them.
I kind of want to separate. I know they're not mutually exclusive, but I want to sort of shape this around Christoph, who, you know, I think it's fair to say had been very open about some of the struggles that he had in his past. I mean, he revealed in his autobiography that he'd suffered, you know, severe bouts of depression after the death of his older sister, and that he had an unbelievably tough childhood. I mean, I think you'll know more about this than I will, but it was an unpleasant childhood at times, and things happened that no kid should have to go through. Did he ever discuss that kind of thing with you, Ben? I mean, were you ever aware of the challenges that he had in a one-to-one basis, or was he only ever just sort of talking about it in print because he perhaps felt safer that way?
To be totally honest, he's so he never spoke in detail what it was, but he used to say, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." You know, that was his type of attitude, to say, "That's what fuels my energy, my inner drive. That's made me who I am. That's why he's indestructible. That's why he wants to reach for the stars." He used it as a fuel and energy to reach his dreams. But it's true that at one point when I was very young, I used to really struggle especially when I came off the bench, just to concentrate and have the relaxed mind enough to concentrate on my throwing. Playing rugby was very easy for me, scrummaging, fighting, whatever, it's okay. I mean, I think the first time I came into the first team, They announced, I was in Béziers, I remember, that we were leading by 40 points or something. Come off the bench, you're like, you know, you got nothing to lose. We are smashing them. Enjoy, kid. The first line out, I throw to the back of the head of the loose head prop because I completely crumbled. I just went, you know, I tried to stop in the middle and I chucked it on the loose head prop right in his head. And there's somebody jumping at the back of the line looking at me and everybody's looking, what happened to you? And then the first ball that I catch, it bounced off my chest. I missed a tackle, whatever. And I remember sitting in that locker room and I felt like I was half my size, just tiny. I wanted to roll into a ball, you know, and hide somewhere in somebody's bag. And Domi came to see me and, Fabien Galtier came to see me. He just shook his head and went, and then walked off. He said, I like you, but if you play like that, you're never going to play again. And then walked off. Oh, okay. Oh, awesome. So he gave me a shovel, basically. And Domi came and he made a joke because that's what he does. You know, he was just like bouncing around, whatever. And we were sort of chatting about, you know, getting help. He says, honestly, the strongest men, if you deal with your shit by yourself, it will only make you stronger. So I believe that's what he thought. That's the way that he saw it. And that might be the distinction that you're trying to say about team motivation, performance, and health. Performance is worth to take the shot to do on your own because it will only make you stronger. It will only deliver later, but it's for performance. So it's not anything important. Well, not too important. But health is different. Health, you have to be helped because it's not in everybody's heads.
The really sad thing about this is that this is not the first time we've spoken in this context about a former player who struggled and has felt it will get too much. And I'd be pretty sure that this won't be the last either. But it feels like there is a willingness, you know, for progress to be made. I just wonder, when you look at the journey that you went on as an elite sportsman, what gets you to the top feels like what therefore leads to some of these problems. It's an obsession. It's a drive. It's a physical, you know, challenge. It's all the things that get you there are
it's a almost need for pain. Almost.
Yeah. It almost feels you are more vulnerable as a result of getting to the top than those of us who bumble along in the middle lane to middle age. I mean, of your crew in 2003, a lot of them had come through that amateur era and therefore probably had deeper roots in society and whatever it was. But do you recognise amongst that lot the challenges that we talk about here?
Well, I think if you look at it from that point of view and you look at 2003, then sort of my generation was the first one to go straight from school into professionalism. So didn't really either fall behind a uni background or previous jobs or whatever. So that's sort of the era where it started. I don't know, myself, I seem to have a great sort of thing where I don't ever think about what was yesterday. So I don't ever think about my rugby career really anymore. And it's more what's next. But what I do miss is and what I do think is poor is sometimes clubs' ability to keep former players involved with each other. I know Bath are very good at it. They'll do 7 to 10 events a year where I still get invited back and I hadn't played there for 15 years. Gloucester are just trying to start doing it. Because if you can get those guys back together, sometimes you stay close to your 5-6 friends, you know, my Simbads, my Bolshers, Hazy, Nicky Robinson, people who I played with. But then some of the ones you're really close with at former clubs, you don't often get back to see. And I think that support ongoing from a club is important. You look at Wasps, when you're a Wasp, always a Wasp, they have a good, strong background, even though it has mainly gets abused on that WhatsApp group. But it's a group that's there and they have a strong foundation that seems to stay together. And I think that is something that clubs could also add, is making sure that you, once you've played for a club, you're part of it. Because that normally brings back a flood of old emotions and people generally want to know what you've been up to and it starts that conversation. Now, where that conversation will lead will always be dictated by what the person wants to tell you. But I think you miss out on opportunities like that. You can sort of slip into a life where you forget your past and then you suddenly still feel there's a void that was behind you because you don't want to look back and put all your... You're sort of restarting your life, aren't you, once you leave. But you're starting at the bottom rung, but you might get a lift up to the top rung, but you don't feel that you've earned it. So there's that to deal with as well. There is a better way of pulling this all together where players shouldn't feel like they've become isolated when you can do that. If you blokes you crap on the phone, well, I am. I know Hask is very good at it, but, you know, I don't necessarily pick up the phone all the time, even though I might think about people. I don't necessarily then pick up the phone and just check how they are. And it's something I am trying to get better at. But I think that there is that void that then happens, like what you talked about with the military. Once you're out, you're sort of out. You've left all 100 mates that you had in it and you're starting again. And I think there's got to be a bridge that allows you to stay connected. And that mainly is the clubs. But then what Hass talked about in terms of having then that support through it would then hopefully lead to that as well a little bit.
Can I ask you a very direct question, Tim? Of that oath, and I remember Jason Robinson on the show he did with us said there'd only been one meet-up of that 03 squad in the 17 years since, which I found utterly extraordinary, particularly given what you've gone through, how valuable that support network might be. The player who was most open about the struggles off the back of that was Johnny. Were you as good a friend to Johnny as he needed it at the point when he needed it? Or often does it come down to whether the player will let you in?
Look, I think with Johnny, I didn't know the depths that he took him to. And I spoke to him all the time. I kicked with him all the time. And then when he finished, obviously we finished around the same time. We had a conversation back in July 2014 about it. But then Johnny immediately gets moved on to something else. And he is notoriously hard to get hold of. And we occasionally have a conversation. When we do, it's a good conversation. But I would say, ultimately, it's never enough. It's famous for you ring him in January in 2019, you get a reply in January 2020 like it was 2019. But, you know, it's just like no time has passed and he's replying to your message. And it's like, well, that was a year ago, Johnny. Something's changed since then. But it is down to a player's realisation, because you have enough shit going on. I mean, if you're someone like Wilco, and I imagine everyone wants his time, you can get caught up in that. But then that doesn't deal with, you know, the people that you have been to. And he is right. We've only had one get together since 2003, the 10-year reunion, which is ridiculous and farcical from everyone's point of view. But that, unfortunately, sometimes is the way it is. And I don't think it's the right way. If I got asked on one tomorrow, I'd be there. Then the questions come up of who drives it, rather than the players just go, if you get five players, say, right, I'm going to do a dinner here. I want all of you to come. Let's sit and see who turns up. Quite a few would turn up. Then there would definitely be some that wouldn't.
Really. Ben, I don't mean this as a sort of a sharp question, but inevitably in the circumstances that you've been through over the last week, we're sort of talking about Tins and Johnny, do you find yourself asking yourself, you know, what if, should I have done more? Is that a, you know, it's a path no one wants to go down, but it's often a path you end up wandering down with reference to Christoph.
Not individually, because it was more... it was more one direction sort of relationship. He gave me, I don't think I ever gave him anything. He was there to help me all the time. I tried to, but I couldn't, you know, there was that sort of distance from age and respect and hierarchy. I think I would feel out of place to text him, you know, to say, can I help you and stuff. But I did feel that collectively, Mike is spot on about the fact that, you know, I said about having the tools. That's professionals who give us the tools. But the support network is very important. And then a super important support network is, by sort of extension, still need to be connected to your brotherhood of the club. And the club is, even the word, the club, it just means a lot. It's like a sanctuary. It's a place where you can come and see each other and feel part of. You know, there's a lot of clubs where guys need to buy a ticket if they want to come in the stand. And then you're ashamed because you're like, oh, I look like an idiot if I go buy a ticket, you know. But at the same time, if they don't give you one, you're not going to ask for it, because otherwise you're going to look greedy. So whatever, it's all this battle in between. So I didn't feel individually, but I really felt that collectively we should have created an environment where anybody who leaves, as long as they've shared the jersey and put a bit of blood in it with me, then they need to be part of my extended environment, definitely.
Ben, I'm really interested, because I think this is what separates us as sports people, or anybody who retires from anything, from kind of normal people. What was your experience when the music stopped in retirement? Like, what was your thing? What happened to you when you stopped?
Basically, I was meant to play for another 2 years, but in January, my neck started to go bad, and I had two operations already on two levels, and it's now just the third level under that was playing up. I've got tingles in my arms and my fingers all the time and stuff. So it was really like I was losing strength in my arm. So the extent would be to lose a limb, you know? So I'm like, listen. And that was the bad case scenario. And the good case scenario is that there's so much arthrosis and all that in there that maybe in 15 years, you don't know the damage that it's going to be, and you're going to have problems with your hands. I'm like, man, in 15 years, I want to be 50. I want to be running everywhere, playing tennis with my girls, and I'll still be young, you know? So basically I thought about it, but I say that I thought about it, but I didn't. I basically took the decision to cut at the end of the season and finish strong rather than take stupid risks. And so basically it wasn't really planned. It was a bit of a last minute thing. My last game was the 16th of June, 2019. 17th, 18th, we're in Clermont. 19th, I left. I gave my car back. I went to the club to knock to say, by the way, I need to resign from my contract because I sell out another 2 years. Oh, yes, we forgot. So I'm the one who knocked on the financial guy to say, listen, I just want to... I'm the type of guy who would rip the bandage straight away, you know? So the Monday, I went to give my car back. The Monday afternoon, I resigned. The Tuesday morning, we're on the plane. We took a five-day holiday with my wife and my girls in Corsica, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. I landed... Oh, no, I was in the plane. And my wife was like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm leaving the WhatsApp group. And she always used to take the piss out of me because that phone is just pinging all night. Bang, bang, especially on a Saturday when the old fella like me, I wouldn't go out anymore. But all the young ones like bang, bang, bang. You know, you get all the banter the next morning stuff. And it was like my TV, you know, you would just watch it like soap opera or something. And that was, you joke, but that was my daily thing. I think I would spend, I don't know, on average, you probably spend an hour a day watching that thing. It is like a community. And in the plane, I wrote a long message to everyone and then you leave. So you don't even see the replies or anything, you know? She's like, oh, you're right. Yeah, it's fine. And so basically one after the other, I was just ripping the bandages as fast as I can. And then once we got back from holiday, I got an offer to do commentary for the World Cup 2019. And from then it's been nonstop. Then I had a challenge to apply for Oxford. So I was studying every day until like 2 o'clock in the morning to finalize my bloody application. But I got through it and I've just been, you know, stepping on it ever since. So I haven't stopped. And because of COVID and because of the lack of rugby money, I haven't been going on holiday yet either. And we're building a house now where we are. Well, we're transforming a house. So basically everything's been like nonstop from then. Have not pressed pause and I'm just grabbing everything. I think I'm spreading myself a little bit too thin because I'm saying yes to everything. You want to go somewhere? Yes. You want to try this? Yes. You know, I'm just a bit like, but you were saying just trying a bit of everything. And I hope that someday I will be able to refocus, assess what happened, and actually choose things rather than just taking everything on.
It's funny, isn't it? Because that is a conversation that I think all of us have said. So I said it, you know, when I retired, straight away, said yes to everything. Things I didn't want to do, said yes, because rugby players are built on hard work, generally hard work, wanting to do stuff. And then 6 months in, I've done loads of stuff that I didn't want. I haven't had any time. I haven't been at home. This is sort of bullshit. I'd been in a jungle with Bear Grylls. I'd been on the jump with Chloe. And I had a one-year-old at home who had just disappeared, basically. And I'm very much like you, Ben. I didn't want to finish playing, but then as soon as that option was taken away, it was like, bang, all right, I'm out. I'm not going back coaching. I'm going to take a year away. I'm just going to go and do my own thing, and then I'll figure it out. And it was 6 months where... random stuff that I didn't really want to do. Yeah, there was some fun stuff in there, but once the fun soon fades when you get to the end of it. And was that 6 months helpful to me in terms of making me find out what I wanted to do? Possibly, but ultimately I think I could have got there without having to have been away as much and everything else.
Oh, to do it in 6 months, hey Hask. 2 years in, still like a blue-ass fly.
Yeah, I mean,
genuine question, because, you know, I'll put my cards on the table. I, in an absolute microcosm of the three of you, when I left Sky 2.5 years ago, it absolutely skittled me, properly skittled me. And even thinking back now, my Twitter handle was at Sky Sports Alex P, and my parents got pissed off with me and would sort of call me Sky Sports Alex Payne because I'd grown too big for my boots. My wife sort of... It was absolutely 100% my identity was linked to the place of my work. And I properly went through the depths before finding Mike and Hask and ending up doing a fairly shambolic podcast and seeing the light and a whole lot of other things. But I mean, Hask, for you, you have, and we've spoken about this, you have been going round the roundabout, going faster and faster and faster, wondering what the hell the exit is that you're meant to be taking. And I just wondered where you're at with that. And if you are... You know, we talk about tools. Ben is talking about the tools to help you survive a crash like that. Where are you at with it?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting. I mean, firstly, you know, I feel really equipped. It doesn't matter. I still have bad days and good days. And you know, both you and Mike are brilliant at it. And, you know, look, we all go through stuff. And I'm an eternally positive person and very good at compartmentalizing. I do get stresses at times, you know, when it comes overwhelming. And then if you're busy, you know, I always equate it very much like a shark. If a shark stops swimming, it dies. And from what's sounding, what Ben's done and what I've done is very similar. Because if you don't stop, yeah, then you don't have to ever focus on your emotions. You never have to go, there's no reflection. If I keep working, keep going, I never have to sit around. Unfortunately, with lockdown, it's put a break on everything. And you do sit down. I've sat in this very chair and Chloe's sitting in the kitchen. And I sat down, I turned to her and I was like, what the fuck am I doing? And she was like, what do you mean? I said, well, what the actual fuck am I doing? Like, all my work stuff stopped. All the stuff, politics, you know, I'm doing this, what are you doing? And because she's brilliant, we sat down, we got a piece of paper out. It's as simple as that. And because I got, you know, because I can switch in and out those modes, just by putting down things that I was interested in, the good, the bad, the rugby, my autobiography, things I enjoyed, all of it around performing, it centered me. And then I felt like I had some direction. But I also am having, and put my hand up, a crisis of identity. I struggle, you know, and I think this is what, I know Ben's, you know, does a brilliant job, and I commented on the weekend about his fantastic commentary. You know, he's fantastic on our podcast. But there is a moment when the work doesn't come or whatever, and you understand that you, and look, you're going to Oxford to study, so you're upskilling yourself, so it's a different kind of vibe. But I sit here sometimes and go, I was a rugby player that I don't really remember doing, well, not because I've had two knocks there, but I don't really resonate with anymore. I do stuff that I sort of enjoy, but I'm known for something and I don't really have an identity. It's like, am I a DJ? Am I a podcaster? Am I an author? Am I a public speaker? Am I a TV presenter? And it's very difficult. And when things are going well, you feel brilliant. When they're bad, I do catch myself sitting down. And what I've realised is that a lot of what I do is keeping myself busy is to deflect from that. But actually, I'm lucky because all the things I do is I actually enjoy. And as long as I have some tasks to fulfill, I feel good. And if I enjoy the moments, and the one thing that I think that we never allow ourselves to do as sports people and very successful people, business people, everything else, is to actually have a minute for yourself. Because you're either running towards something that you really want to do or you're running away from something that you don't want to do. You know, there isn't really a difference in between. You're sort of either got something you really like or you're trying to get away from something. I realized that a lot of time I was trying to get away from things as opposed to running towards something that I was really passionate about. But now, every day, I sit down and I've started doing this new treatment stuff, actually, for another show. It's a bit revolutionary. And I sit there and I sort of do some breathing and I relax or I sit outside and I have a cigar or I make myself a coffee. And I just take in the moment in the silence. And it's nice because I feel like, you know, my book came out and I was like, right, and I've launched a podcast. And the podcast launched that and I did another one. And there was never any moment to go, let's reflect. But I'm interested to see whether Ben has any fears when you do stop, when you get that moment when you're sitting in those university halls or university house and think, you know, what happens when you actually look at it and go, what am I doing now?
For one, in England, you guys have got great, what you like to call socializing, but it just means getting pissed. So even students, you know, at 8 o'clock, once they're done, we hit the pub straight away. So there's no time to stop. There's no time to think about it. But I think one of the best advices I got was from Yannick Nyonga, who I saw he was training like an animal as soon as he finished. And he finished almost a year too early, but because he had a great offer from Jackie Lorenzetti to become, he's like team manager, you know, like director of rugby, but the French director of rugby. You're the link between the president and the sport. You're the link between the office and the back office and the management staff. And he kept on training. He's like, why are you training that much? He's like, honestly, it's 150% for my mental health. And he says, you'll see. The only advice I can give you is train like an animal. And I was like, ah, stuff it, whatever. Because I was always being relatively big. So I'll get fat and chubby, but I'll never get small. And after that 16th of June 2019, I did nothing for about 5 weeks. After 5 weeks, my wife came to see me. She sat me down. She said, listen, we got to do something. And it wasn't so much about my appearance. It was literally about my brain. I would snap at anything. I was short-tempered. When you got little ones, you know, you need to have patience and this and that and keep your cool head. And I was just very irritable, very up and down. Like I would get angry, like, you know, leave her, come back. And she just never knew how to handle what to do. And she was just getting really frustrated with it. And that helped me massively. Just get my anger out. It's not really anger. I don't have like anger inside of me, but just release that emotional, physical anger that you need to release at some point. But the second point that I want to make is go back to what Mike said earlier, which is spot on. When you've been so good at something, you never feel legitimate in anything else. And so whenever you try something else, they're like, oh, but because of rugby, you know, you should have, you could, you learned this. And I'm like, yeah, but hang on. If I go into the real world, they'll tell me that I'm just a fool. Come on. Well, whatever I've learned for 16 years can never be applied. And the one thing that Oxford has taught me is that it can, to be honest, but I needed the tools again to learn how to acknowledge that. Like, you should see me at the back of the, I'm at the back of the thing and we're doing accounting, analytics, whatever. And there's like blood coming out of my ears. My brain is melting. I don't understand a thing that's going on. And I really, really struggle. Whenever we do leadership or whatever, they did it. We do a module on tough conversations. Tough conversations is difficult conversations. It's literally sitting down in front of a guy and telling him, well, listen, this is what's good. This is what's bad. This is what you need to do. Blah, blah, blah. It's not tough. That's what we're used to almost every week. With a bit of respect, they learn you need to be respectful. Straight to the point. Yeah, okay, that's what we do day in, day out. Are we actually going to have a module on this? You know, so so we do learn a lot, but I didn't feel legitimate. I really didn't feel, I thought I was out of my reach completely. And it's true that that I will struggle at. So that's what literally what I'm doing with my studies. I want to be legitimate. So learn from the other world, get my rugby CV to try to go for them. Number one in the row to number two, and then I can decide what I want to do.
There would definitely be some coaches of the past who need to go do that modular.
Yeah. But that is 100%. That is a genuinely valid point here. I mean, you know, we sort of seem to say it week in, week out, whatever the topic is that we're discussing, is that lots of people are talking about it, but there isn't a lot of action. And I mean, Tim's, how do we make progress with this? Is this something that needs to be ready? I mean, there's some brilliant organizations out there. You know, Ben, you've mentioned Loose Heads. There's another one called Brave Mind, which I know has got a very rugby centric angle to it. There are some very good people out there trying very hard to make progress on it. Is it just about access? What is it that means that, you know, this is the last time we talk about a star taken from us too early because they didn't feel they had the support they needed?
I don't know. I don't know whether there is the possibility of like a transition plan.
I think that's a great idea. I think that's a great idea.
You put in X amount a month through your whole career. So you have a little pot. It doesn't have to be a huge amount. And you get a transition period where they build a course where you can have a month-long transitioning where you've got the money from the past that can support you through that. And you can go through a course of A, identifying skill sets. What is your strengths? Is it public speaking? Is it more around the leadership role? And maybe that would be the way forward, is to build a genuine thing that every player funds into, and then you are supporting every player. And if he leaves his journey too early through injury, that's why you've been paying that money. You've still got it, and it's backed up by the entity that you create to do it. I think that would be an amazing sort. It would save 2 years of blue ass flying, 6 months. And whether then you can tailor that in better. I know the RPA try and do stuff, and people have different opinions on the RPA in terms of identifying what you might want to do post. But I still think to deal with the day that it just, the band-aid gets ripped, a period of time where A, you've planned for because you've been putting money into a little well for you, and then have that support and have a transition out type course.
Fascinating. And I mean, we were going to talk rugby. We'll have 5 minutes on the rugby in just a moment or two. I just want to finish, Has, because I didn't actually ask you, obviously knowing Christoph as you did with your time at Stad, how you will remember him. And Ben, just to finish it off, I'd love to ask you how you think Christoph would like to be remembered.
When I first turned up to Stad, obviously I knew exactly who Christoph Dominici was. I was actually at that France-New Zealand game, albeit in the nosebleeds, watching that occasion, and was, you know, La Maison and Dominici, and the guy's absolutely like killing it. And he, you know, he was an absolute hero. I went to watch Wasp versus Stade Francais, you know, at the old Jean Bouin Stadium. Diego Dominguez was playing at 10, Dominici, you know, all these kind of unbelievable
things. I was there as well.
Yeah, and I fell in love with it. You know, Kenny Logan, I think, missed the kick. Classic Kenny.
They got wiped.
Yeah, and it was amazing. And actually, that day I went up to Nigel Melvin and told him I was going to be the WASC number 8 one day, and he like laughed in my face. And then, you know, unlucky Nigel I was. But you know, it was he was an amazing player. And when I turned up for my very first session at Stad, we were playing touch outside. And I remember he watching me, and I was being a bit tentative, and Dominic was sort of taking the piss a bit because his English wasn't amazing, so I didn't really have that necessary rapport. But he was taking a minute, and then for one minute, because it was pre-season, I ran through a gap and I did like an out the back door no look offload, and someone scored, and he was like clapping me on the back, and he was lovely. But well, by the time I turned up to Stad, they kind of had 6 months of him and Ewan McKenzie, and he was sort of a bit of a broken man by the end of it. And I don't know if I'm completely accurate with this, but I think he sort of had a bit of a breakdown when he got asked to leave by Max again, because obviously he was like Max's sort of adopted son, really. And I think there was some sort of bad moment, but I never spoke to him and saw him again. But I'll always remember him as an incredible, iconic player, a lovely, smiley guy. But I, as I said, my relationship was very different than Ben's, but he did appreciate an out-the-back-door offload from a man with no discernible handling skills. So that was quite good.
Ben, how do you think Christoph would like to be remembered? And how does some good, any good, something come out of this, which means his name lives on in the right way?
I think that the player Dominici would like to remember that nothing's untouchable, nothing's impossible, that your biggest asset is your heart and your passion, and that collectively a human endeavor, a human sort of human fire inside each other's hearts, if we convince that we can do something collectively, only the sky's the limit. I think that's the type of player that he was. And as a human being, I think he would be very attached to say that he was a furious competitor with huge drive who never forgot who he was. He was always the one to lend a hand. He was a huge star, but he was the most incredibly down-to-earth person. And I think that would be very, very dear to him and very, very important to be remembered that way. A ballsy, incredibly ambitious, incredibly talented, absolutely normal human being, basically in touch with who he was, his roots, his family history, and just a normal life.
Amazing. You've put that so beautifully. I mean, he was a smouldering Gaelic rugby superstar. I saw a picture on Twitter, I think it was, of him arriving at the Pearly Gates. It was a cartoon, him arriving at the Pearly Gates and God introducing him to Jonah and Chester. There's quite a back three coming together up there somewhere, but Ben, thank you so much. I'm conscious this is maybe a 5-10 minute chat, but actually I hope it's been quite therapeutic, and I'm conscious of your time. Ben, are you happy to stay for 5 more minutes with just a quick word on the weekend?
Yeah, no problem.
It sort of sums up 2020, really, that we've got a grand final between an England side that's lost once this year and a French side that feel they should have won the Six Nations and are playing some of the best rugby in the Northern Hemisphere, and certainly some of the best rugby that they've been playing for a long time. And yet France are picking a C team. Just talk us through why that's the case, what the sort of attitude is in France to the fact that the legals seem to have won out over the selectors.
It's not the legal. It's the president's kicking a fuss. It all goes down to the fact that nobody's shooting in the same direction. So we thought by February 2020, this new double World Cup winners of the under-20s are going to be the new shining, incredibly talented generation for French rugby, and we'll all get excited with it. We thought that the attraction of the World Cup being 3 years down the line in France was going to be heavy enough for everybody to say, listen, let's stop joking around now, and we need to actually compile strength and quality to all shoot in the same direction. We thought it was. We beat England brilliantly. We beat Italy decently. We had an incredible game in Wales and a disappointing one in Scotland. Okay, after that, the pandemic hit the world and rugby in France is really shaken and still is shaken massively. The economic impact is absolutely ginormous. Nobody has a clue what the consequences will be. I think in March, it is very possible that we will have, not an earthquake, but I mean, a couple of clubs who will be down to say, listen, do we live or die? And that is spectacular. Whatever the help they can do, because most clubs already took those, I don't know what you had in England, but in France for businesses, so including rugby clubs, there was mortgages backed by the government that you could take up to sort of 25% of your last year's income or 50% of what you lost. So for clubs, it was a couple of million bucks. So it was really heavy. But that mortgage, you still need to pay it back at some point. You still need to generate the extra income in the future. Yes, it is a saving sort of, I don't know how you call that, but whatever, you know, when you're drowning in the sea and they chuck that orange thing to you. Yes, you can grab that on for a while, but it's not a solution. It's a temporary fix, not a solution. So the attitude of the club in the league when we thought they were going together completely dismantled as soon as, which is the same with, we're not getting into politics, but when things are good, everybody's, you know, up for sharing. And when things are bad, we all become very, very nationalistic. And Brexit, there you go. And all those things, you know, we started thinking that differently. So unfortunately, clubs had to think about themselves first, because it is a live or die situation. And then the test match rugby of November got transformed into the Auto Nations Cup. They did add two features. So France were only meant to play three games. I think in England, you guys play four games. But in France, it was only meant to be three. Not only, they knew they had to finish the Six Nations, so the Ireland game had to be finished. That was pretty understood by everyone. But on top of that, the Auto Nations Cup added a fifth one. And on top of that, the Federation added a friendly game to Wales just before. So the previous November test of three ended up 6 weeks. Within those 6 weeks, you always need to give a week of holiday to your international players and all that. So basically, you're like, listen, we're struggling with money. Desperate to see some quality top 14, otherwise the broadcaster will not pay us. We're desperate to get just a little bit of excitement, keep our sponsors happy, something. And now you're taking the players for 6 weeks or 7 weeks. So they kicked them ass at first and they're like, listen, we will try, we will this, we will that. And what the league took really badly is that on top, when they heard that those conversations were happening, they say, we're ready to release the players 5 weeks. And they thought they were giving everything. And then the Federation said, no, it's six. And they wouldn't budge. So they fought dramatically to the point that in October, you know, when you thought February 2020, everybody's like this. October 2020, they threatened not even to release the players. So last minute, they had to shake a deal. I don't even know. That's why I said, you said it's the law that won. I don't even know how it would have went. They say they don't release the players. What about Echard Vollivant just pick up his bag and goes to play for the French team?
I read. The reason I mentioned the legals is that I read somewhere that if the players had played more than the three games, the lawyers would have been involved, but French rugby starts to eat itself.
Because they signed an agreement. But nobody forced them to sign the agreement. I think they just did it out of, because they were desperate. And because, let's face it, nobody really knows what this Auto Nations Cup is. Japan was meant to be here, they're not here. Fiji, unfortunately, didn't play. The stadiums are empty. The Six Nations without stadiums is not going to be the same competition. It is there. But we are all, and I'm sure you guys will agree, absolutely delighted to see international rugby week in, week out. We love this stuff.
Yeah.
And all we care about is having some quality games. So basically, they were strong-armed into accepting this deal of only having three appearances in a game. I thought it was three times 80 minutes. Actually, it's three appearances. And they decided to play it the fact that I was surprised. I thought they would skip the Fiji game, to be totally honest, and go for the full squad in Scotland. But because the Fiji game got cancelled, they were allowed to actually skip that one and go. And so basically, we end up with a situation where you put your second team against Italy and you say that it's great because you can find some depth, which is true. Your starting 15th for the French team is basically almost found for the next 3 years. And hallelujah. I mean, it's been a long, long time. We've been waiting for a strong, positive, young, dominant starting 15. Extraordinary. But you still need 35, 40 players to be able to actually reach for the stars, because that's what that's the goal. The goal is not to qualify for the quarters in 2023 and be happy with it. The goal is actually to try to challenge the best and to try for once to give ourselves the possibility of seriously being challengers or going for the title. So they're looking for depth, which is what they're doing. And I thought it was a little bit disappointing the way the game went last week, because Sekou Makalou is an absolute rock star. You guys will love him in the next few months. He is extraordinary. But he caught his first ball in two hands at the 78th minute. He dropped the first three. You could tell the guys were shaking. They weren't really in their skin. They didn't know each other. And they just tried to play defensive. It really wasn't that. Teddy Thomas, I was going mental in the commentary, trying to kick his first three balls. Teddy Thomas is the fastest rugby player in world rugby at the moment. You guys rave about the Gloucester guy.
Johnny May.
Not Johnny May. The other guy, the Welsh guy.
Lewis Rees Sammet. He is Welsh.
Johnny May. Yes. Johnny May is crazy quick. But the other guy is meant to be like lightning fast. Yeah. In his first cap against France, you watch. He gets the first ball on the wing. He has a tiny overlap on Teddy Thomas. Teddy Thomas catches him in about 4 meters. And he's barely jogging. He scored a try against Italy where he's barely jogging. This guy, he's a freak of nature speed-wise, but he needs to learn to do the hard stuff, because he's doing my head and I'm going to lose my shit with somebody who just never does the hard stuff. He's too easy, too good, and he doesn't want to do Ben, work. So
the time that the fullback Dulin, when actually Teddy Thomas ran back with him and actually supported him, he then scored a try.
Exactly.
And you flagged it up in the commentary, and I quite admire it, because obviously you're new to the scene, but it is nice, because you know there's no point in having Rolls Royce speed if you've got exactly. The work rate of a scooter. So I thought it was pretty good spot for you, and I think it'll be interesting to see how he develops. But yeah, you were spot on your commentary on that.
You know, I was going to say, what we've talked about on the show and what I've always said about French rugby is there was always far too much politics from the senior players a lot of the time, if you think of some of the people of the past, whether it be Yash, Michelet. Rougerie, they always got involved, and we always said that if someone comes in and offers something different, if they don't like it, it's gone, and they disappear into the ether. Is it getting to the point now where I think what has happened in French rugby in terms of from the playing squad, in terms of embracing these under-21s, that you know, world championships twice, is what's going to change the game in France? Is it now time that all those people that have shifted up the ladder, which seems to happen in France, and now sit at the FFR and probably have too much power over the game, who come from the thing that we want to get rid of in French rugby, do they need to go? Does the board need a clean sweep at the FFR and have some younger thinking ideas that are actually going to try and knit together the relationships between the clubs and France, where everyone is still working to have France as the pinnacle and the goal? We want to see French rugby at the top of the world, and the clubs have to buy into that, and we're all pushing in the same direction. Or are we going to let people who just love the power sit at the top and manipulate it all around, and then we'll always cave to what the club owners want? Is it time to have that sweep and maybe go with a different way? Or is that possible? Or is that never going to happen?
I thought it was never going to happen. But if there's one guy who's capable of doing it, it's Bernard Laporte. Whether you like him or not, Bernard Laporte has got special ways, yes. But Bernard Laporte, who's like this with Dominici, very, very similar people. Someone said to him, you will never get the Federation. He got elected once. He got re-elected. Some said, you will never get the World Cup. The World Cup is in France in 2023. Some said the Federation is going to go bust because all the sponsors are going to leave you and this and that. And Renault are leaving. The bank is full now because he signed contracts all over the shop. So he's one of those guys, a bit like Dominici. It would have been funny to see if you put a piece of steak in the middle of the forward pack of Stade Français. It would have been either Dominici or Bernard Laporte who get the steak, because they're incredibly feisty, very, very similar people. Long story short, yes, Bernard Laporte, I think, is the one who can kick into this whole Shazam, like you said, the presidents of the league having too much pressure. And Bernard Laporte is the only one who can do it. But I would be surprised, and mark my words, I think within a year or a year and a half, the league is gone. Whether rugby has completely changed and the league has been injected into the federation, or they just kick a fuss and they create their own thing. But I don't see this relationship going on any further.
Wow. I wonder if that's not just
for us. I feel I know more about French rugby now than I do about English.
Yeah. It's been an education. Yeah. I love shows like this. We came with a sort of fag packet plan, as always, to talk about, you know, the rugby and to talk about Autumn Nations Cup and Pumas are All Blacks. And instead, we've had an extraordinary tribute from you, Ben, to a great, great star of French rugby. We've four men chatting, which I think has been good for the soul, and we leave it with a cliffhanger. What on earth's going to happen across the channel? We shall see. Just before we go, I just want to very quickly give a plug to your pod as well, Le French Rugby Podcast, which you've obviously put a lot of time and effort into naming. How's it going? And I mean, you know, you're doing it with the great Johnny Beattie. Are you having fun with it?
We are having fun, but it's precisely what Mike said. You know, he said, he's like, listen, I've learned more. I've been frustrated with the disparity of the knowledge of the UK in French rugby and the reality of French rugby and what they actually know. And so every time I speak English to people, they're like, oh, but explain to me why France has been underperforming for years. Explain to me why this. Explain to me. I was like, but guys, we're literally across the channel. Come and see us. Come and experience this. We're not that far. We should understand each other. And so basically, we wanted to create a show with Johnny Beattie, who's based in Bayonne now. His idea, just to have chats about all that. There's some incredible guests in top 14. I mean, you know, like the world stars are basically between Japan Premiership in here. And so interesting guests, fantastic fun, and just the myths, the reality, the exoticism of French rugby. And with Johnny Beattie, we love doing it.
It's well worth a listen. There's a lot to get into. Ben, thank you so much. Final thoughts, Hask Tins?
We obviously have a lot of men listening. I think, you know, if this isn't another wake-up call to A, to share your feelings and not just tell people you're fine, but also for you to pick up the phone to friends and dig through the crap, the initial, you know, bravado, and just see how people are. And remember that however big problems seem, it is possible to get through them. And, you know, speaking to a therapist is not emasculating. And remember, what Ben said is true. Only we can fix our problems, but sometimes we don't know how to do that. And there's no magic wand, but you learn the skills. And if you don't know how to feel better, somebody can teach you.
I would just add to that. There's always, and I definitely have this. There's always, when someone goes, you're right, there's an initial thought that you choose to ignore. And then you go, yeah, I'm fine. So don't ignore the initial thought of, it might be a small thing. It might not actually, it's not in the big scheme of things. You just think, it sounds like I'm whinging. Go with it. See where it leads you.
Well done, guys. I've really enjoyed this. And I'm sorry if you came today looking for an Autumn Nations debrief, but hopefully those of you who wanted something a bit more, you've got it. It's been a really enjoyable conversation. We will remember Christoph as one of the greats. Ben, you speak so eloquently about so many subjects. I hope people will come and find your podcast. And thank you for hanging around for a lot longer than I think we asked you to. It's been really good to have you on board. And it's been really good to bounce around so many different ideas. Just before we go, we have got a cracking prize up for grabs from none other than Andy Hazel's business, the great man of Gloucester, Smart Home Sounds. We love to help one of the rugby brethren out. He has incredibly offered up the very latest 65-inch A8 OLED TV from Sony, along with a Dolby Atmos soundbar to experience the buzz of games in your own home. I kind of want a cuddly toy in there as well and go all generation game. But the two runners-up are also going to win a Sonos One smart speaker. This is unbelievable. Smart Home Sounds, the place to go if you want to do up your own abode. All you've got to do is help us out with this. So I'm good, apparently. James is bad. Mike's been left with rugby and not terribly happy about it. But Ellis Genge obviously joined our team officially a couple of weeks ago, and it's great to have him on board as the fourth wheel. But what we want you to do is come up with the best, the most creative word to sum him up that A, fits the ethos of the show, and B, and more importantly, we can fit into the title of the podcast as well. So that is your challenge. What word can we give to Ellis in order to bring him into the title of our show? As always, we'll create a thread on our Facebook group. The winner takes home all the prizes that we've mentioned from Smart Home Sounds, and we've got a couple of runners-up prizes as well. And would you believe it, better late than never, we've managed to get some merchandise produced in time for Christmas as well. Head to www.goodbadrugby.com and you can buy yourself a T-shirt, a cup coaster, and other bits and bobs. There's some quite fun stuff there, actually. So go and have a look at the website if you fancy a little Christmas present. Chaps, thank you so much again. Really valuable, really interesting. And I hope, you know, wherever people are listening to this, there's one or two bits that you can buy into and might help a little bit. That is it for this week's show. Do check out Ben's podcast, Le French Rugby Podcast, with he and Johnny Beattie. You can check out our combined team of the week from the third round of games in the Autumn Nations Cup. That's on YouTube for us right now, a special mini show that you can find each week of the tournament. You can also watch the Autumn Nations Cup, the final round, live on Prime Video. You can follow and subscribe to at Prime Video Sport on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter and TikTok. Thank you for listening. I hope there's something in there for everybody. Thank you for watching. Take it away, Rob Brydon. Look after yourselves and we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.